The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
We're starting the show right now because I want to get into this right now.
All right.
Kip Kiefer, Tony Curry, the Kiefer and Curry Show. We were sitting there. We're going to be talking about the TV shows we want to watch. And every single week, you and I will have this miraculous, incredible conversation for about 35 or 40 minutes before we actually start the show. And then I'm like, damn it, why didn't we just start the tape right then? We would have had another show. So I was asking you, I use terms of endearment when I'm talking to friends, and I only have to meet you one time. I'm not really good with names, and I will admit that. But I call people baby and sweet pea and big guy and crazy man. And you know, I used to have people call me up and like, hey, it's crazy man. I'm like, okay. And they're like, hey, you used to call me crazy man. It's crazy man. And I'm like, hey, you called everyone crazy man. And I call people brother. And it's a term of endearment for me. It's a love term for me that if I call you brother or hey, big guy or something like that. And normally, like I never called my wife, my ex now, Nancy, I just call her Hon, or pickle juice or whatever, right? You know what the term was today. And sometimes it comes back to bite you because, you know, if you call someone sweetheart, I mean it a nice way. I mean, I'll call my banker. Thank you. Hey, sweetheart, how you doing today? Or hey, sweet pea. And you know how they're in this thing now where they ain't cool. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's crazy. Yeah. It was like, oh, you called me sweetheart. It's so misogynistic. I'm like, no, I'm just trying to be friendly with you. You know what I mean? And I like it when women call me sweetheart. Or when a woman calls
sure.
me baby, she's getting a bigger tip, right? So I we've done the show
it's
with
so
you for a while,
true.
Right? I mean, you call me baby, you're getting 20%.
You just hit me with a brick there because yeah. I mean, for years today, this is a little bit off topic, but that's why Hooters was such a success early on because you could have a bunch of old fat guys or you know guys that are past their prime go in to have some wings and a couple of beers, and these attractive young ladies with their orange shorts and their tight t-shirts yes. would pull up a stool and sit with you and talk and touch your arm and call you baby and sweetheart mm-hmm. and honey and next thing you know you're writing about twice as big a tip as you would have and for nothing more than just having somebody treat you like a human being.
It's some company. Thank you. You know what I mean? It feels nice to get that company. My ex-father-in-law, who's in his 80s, has been on a wheelchair for 40 years. He's got MS.
Wow.
He brought this woman in, and this woman was a piece of work. We come to find out that she was stealing from him.
But of course.
He needed someone to come in and kind of look after him and make sure he was taking his meds and maybe cooking a meal once in a while and doing some laundry because he was in a wheelchair and he lived by himself. And
yeah.
His widow passed away. She had brain cancer. She passed away about 3 or 4 years ago. And so I would see the glow in his eyes when she walked in the room. And she wasn't so much to look at, but she was probably in her 30s. And again, he's 84, 85 years old. But she made him feel special. She laughed.
Sure.
She laughed at his stupid jokes. You know, he loves to read the Bible, and he would read the Bible, and she'd listen to him when he read the Bible. It was company. It was warm. It was warmth. It was another human being in the house with him, and he really enjoyed that. And come to find out again, she was dealing crack or something out of the basement or something. I don't know what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, Frank, you got to get rid of this girl. You can't have any. And it really hurt him because he was like, I don't care. I really like her company. I really want her to stay here. Please don't get rid of her. And of course, for sake of, you know, her stealing and blind everything else, it was probably the best thing to happen for him. But I mean, sometimes it just feels really, really good to have somebody. And I'm not going to take that away from an older person. I'm not going to do that. I know we're getting way outside the realm of name stuff, but I'm not going to do it. Anyway, to get back to what I was saying, I can't think of a different name to call you than Kip because Kip is already kind of, it's already self-made. It's already like a term of endearment, a Kip is. It's almost like a handle. So sometimes I'll say, hey, Kip or Doodle or hey, big dog or what, you know. So I always find myself just calling you Kip, and you may be the first time in my life that I've actually called by your name the entire time. And I think that's a compliment. I think.
Well,
that's
I'm glad to have a distinctive quality in terms of my title because
yeah.
I don't think a conventional name would really fit me. I've always been kind of outside the box in terms of thinking and
so where did the name
operation.
Kip come from?
Well, it's an interesting story. My dad was William Walston Kiefer. Walston was some old family name on his mother's side. You know, they kept the William. His dad was William Harold Kiefer, and I always thought Harold was kind of one of the, you know, I don't want to be a Harold, but that was kind of a name of we used derisively. If somebody was kind of a creepy guy or a weird guy, we were a teenager, we call him a Harold. And to find out my grandfather had that name was kind of astounding. But the bottom line is, Kip came from a co-worker of my grandmother's who went to work for the Department of Commerce in 1939. She was a career woman working in the government before there was such a thing. She had a coworker who became really ill with some kind of malady, some kind of illness. And over an entire summer, her son, who was named Kip, came and lived with my dad was an only child to my very busy grandmother. But he lived with that kid lived with them for an entire summer till his mother was well enough again to bring him back. And yeah. My dad always liked that name and had good memories of those that summer. And so I was William dubbed after my predecessors. But thankfully, they gave me the middle name of Kip. And for many, many years as a little guy, I was referred to as Kippy. And sometimes my friends still call me that.
Really?
But yeah, that's where the Kip came from. And God bless the original Kip back in the 1950s, because it's been a title I've always liked. And being a writer and in media circles, and Kip Kiefer is the you know, I remember once it, and this is a true story, Tony, in high school, I think I was in ninth grade, and it was one of those days where the regular teacher was out sick or something. They had to hustle somebody in there at the last minute. So they had a substitute, and she didn't have any of the records or the books that, you know, they, of course, the old time, and I'm sure it's a lost art now, of calling roll. So they just passed around a sheet of paper, and you had to sign in and turn it into her. And she was going down the list, and she's going, okay, who's John Williams? And he would kind of raise his hand. Then she got down to me, and she said, Kip Kiefer, obviously a fake name. So I liked that distinction, and I always have. So again, God bless the young man where that gave me my name.
Well, what's pretty amazing too is we came from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, where when you first got into radio, you had to pick a radio name.
Yes.
And I thought it was really weird because I guess back in 1982, 81, when I first got into commercial radio, I was already like 12 or 13 years old, and I was already working. I was already getting paid to play. And they're like, okay, so what's your middle name? And I was like, James. It's like, you're going to be Tony James, or you're going to be Anthony James. And I'm like, why don't I use Curry? Because you want to use something very general. And I always thought that was really interesting. I'm like, why use something really general? Yeah. Why not pick something that's really
something stands out,
something different? I mean, if you ever listen to NPR, I don't even know what I think they make names up on NPR. I can't recognize it. I can't pronounce anyone's name on NPR. It's amazing. There are no Tom Johnsons on NPR.
No, it's Florence Devereaux.
Yeah, it's like I don't know where their names come from. So you know, so I was Anthony James, and then I was Tony Poehler. I don't know where Poehler came from. I just thought it was a cool name.
Yeah.
And I was like, so that's why you meet so many, Justin Browns or someone will take their last name and make it their first name. There'll be Jackson, mm-hmm. Jackson Willis or something like that. And I never understood why they tried to dumb us down and make our names so generalized, whereas you really want to remember who you're listening to and why you're listening to them. And to have a name like Kip Kiefer, why would you want to take that away?
Yeah, I it's funny you're reminding me of that era, because I know, in fact, a guy that was kind of a contemporary of yours much earlier when I was in high school, the big personality on the local station that was playing mostly classic rock, what's become classic rock, was WQXI. His name was Gary McKee. I don't know if you ever heard of him from Atlanta. He was huge for like 20 years. Now Gary is right on the verge of like 80 years old, and he shows up at the last mini high school reunion we had last summer with a girl from my class. He's dating her. So
All of
a sudden, here's Gary McKee, and in talking to him, his real last name was something like, you know, McGillicuddy or McQuacken or something really long and weird. And early on, that's what they did to him. Said, "You're Gary McKee." And he's still to this day, that's who he is. So, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I hadn't really had not thought about that in a long time, but that was the desire back then, do something really easy and really generic. And I think it's the opposite of what they should have done. They should have come up with unique names that people will, that make you stand out.
Well, it's funny too, because, I've always used Tony Curry. People call me Tone the Bone, just as kind of a handle, because it rhymes. I remember Lisa Holyfield, we called her Roxanne. I remember we had a contest, we're going to name the new morning gal, and she was blonde, and she was a little ditzy, and she was really smart. She was a great gal. She was a news girl.
Yeah.
So we called her Roxanne, because that was a good name for, it was a police song, and it was a good song for rock radio. And so you always, we had the Mason and Dixon Morning Show, which goes along with the Mason Dixon line. And so all of a sudden, whoever was Mason, you had to have someone named Mason. You had to have someone named Dixon. And depending on where you were jumping in your career, that it may have been like you're in your mid 30s, and all of a sudden you're changing your name in your mid 30s, and that was the name from that point on that you were going to be. And it's interesting now, because I still know a lot of people. I'm thinking, there's a girl named, is her name Lisa Shannon or Shannon Lisa? I don't remember anyway. And it's funny, because I only know these people by their fake names, because those are the names that they've always used.
Sure.
They were called those names. And even when they would be on a radio station for 10 or 15 years, and they would leave that radio station and go somewhere else, they wouldn't change their name again. They'd keep that name. That was their given name. And so I think it was kind of cool as a radio personality to have a fake name. I think that was, it kind of added to the mystique, the celebrity, if you will, of having a different name. So I thought that was kind of cool. But Kip Kiefer, man, why would you want to change that?
Yeah, for sports, it's
perfect. And I mean,
yeah,
it's funny, because for racing, it's almost perfect. When you talk about some of the names, the racing names that you have in horse and
greyhound
racing. Hey, so where does the name Kiefer come from? What background is that? What origin is that?
It's predominantly German.
Okay.
My mother-in-law, God rest her soul, who's left us not quite a few years ago, I guess 7 or 8 years ago, but in the later part of her life, when she had some leisure time after raising six kids, including my lovely ex-bride, she got really into genealogy stuff and going out and going to different parts of the country to go into courthouses and actually delve into records. She didn't call like ancestor.com or whatever it is. She wanted to go do the work herself. It really gave her something, that she found interesting and enjoyed doing.
There was always somebody in every family growing up in the 70s and 80s. There was always that one person in the family, that aunt, their uncle, or someone that kind of took it upon themselves to copy back through the genealogy tree. Do you remember that? It was always there was always someone in somebody's family. They were the persons that went, and it was really fascinating. It was a hell of a hobby. I mean, because it would take years to build this tree. Go ahead, continue.
And it took so much effort. So one Christmas, I get this kind of large present. It's from Janine, my mother-in-law. I'd been married to Kathy for probably 7 or 8 years at this point. And I unwrap it, and it is a like scrapbook looking thing. And it is all this. I mean, I tell you, this maybe was one of the most meaningful gifts I've ever received from anybody, that she had done all these hours of work on my family lineage and background. And it was page after page of all these documents she'd copied and different, stories about my descendants. And
wow.
I mean, what a meaningful thing to give me. And it was absolutely, I was stunned. I mean, I was literally I had tears in my eyes. But it was so cool to look back, and the Kiefer family traced back into the 1600s of originally immigrating to North America and were predominantly based in upstate New York and even in around the Canadian border. And they were, these guys were engineers and builders and, you know, constructed bridges and art. They were architects. They were all these like technical guys. And I was like, I'm like the complete, I can't hang a birdhouse out back, you know? to find out that was the background of that particular family, was really kind of amazing. And there was a couple of congressmen and some other people, back in the 1800s. Whereas my other side of the family is, the James family, and another German family, the Brundages. So I got a bunch of krauts on both sides.
There you go.
But the Brundages had 11 daughters. They settled in West Virginia. They came in about the middle 1800s, had 11 daughters.
Wow.
They never had a son, had 11 daughters, including my grandmother, my mother's mother, Della Brundage. And she was twice married and produced my mother as an afterthought, I guess. Back in those days, it wasn't that unusual. She had already had four children and then had a 16-year gap before my mother was born when she was 41 years old. So some really interesting anomalies in all that history. And to have all that was just phenomenal to experience and find out, you know, who you are and where you come from. Yeah. And it's not usually what you expect.
No, we came from a family of Bruckers, talk about German, and Currys. It's K-U-R-R-E. And chances are, if you run into another Curry with a K and an E, chances are we're related to them somehow. There's just not that many of them. And it was interesting because when you talk about, when you say generations, people think generations are 60, 70 years. They think it's an entire lifetime. A lifetime is a lifetime. A generation is roughly 17 to 20 years. That's how long it takes to have a child, right?
And then
a child. So you can be 50, 60 years removed and be a third generation. And it was inevitable that back in that time, because our country is so stinking young, unless you've been over to England or something where you're walking in a pub that was created in 1263, which is crazy. you walk over there.
Which they still have.
Yeah, they have pubs that are like, you know, this was established in 1543. You're like, holy smokes. And you think about just how young the United States of America is.
Yes.
It's 1776. I mean, we are pups. I mean, we are pups. And here we come swanking on the block and we're telling them how things are going to be done. And we're democratic and we've got the best country in the world, blah, blah, blah. We are so stinking young. But I mean, it was almost inevitable that if you did a genealogy thing, you're going to be related to someone famous.
You've got
to be related to someone famous. And now knowing that we just did that back in the 60s, 70s and 80s, which obviously is just a couple of two, three generations removed. You could probably go back. You know, it's funny because that is big business. And now you can do the genealogy of your pets. I don't know if you saw that. You can now do
it. No,
yeah. You can find out where your pet is from. But, you know, it's really interesting because it has opened up a Pandora's box for a lot of people that, quite frankly, don't want to know the truth.
Yes.
We're finding out that that mother you had wasn't really your given mother, and then we're finding you were adopted, and we're finding that your father was the actual brother of so-and-so and blah, 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 blah. And the next thing you know, you've got distant cousins that you're not aware of. My brother-in-law, who's a psychiatrist married to my sister, went through it himself. This is about 20 years ago before Ancestry 21 and all these findthefamily.com and all these things came out, and he actually went back and started finding and found out that he was adopted and found out that he had two brothers, and in his mid-30s it was up to him in his endeavor to find out more about his two brothers. And he really kind of took it on to the point where he was going to quit his job, and just he felt like it was something he just needed to do. And unfortunately, one of those brothers had no clue that they had a brother as well. They were very, very happy, but the other one didn't want to have anything to do with it.
Wow.
He had just lived a different life, and it was just too much of a shock. And I, the only thing I can think of as an analogy is Elf. You know, when what's his face finds out that Will Ferrell is his long lost son. You know, and first of all, he comes home and he tells the wife that he's got a son, and I would never see a wife use that, be that ecstatic. That's wonderful. You have a son. Yeah. I don't know how many wives would actually go, "You have a son. That's wonderful news, Walter. That's wonderful."
Yeah, that's not real life.
No, you throw that in the middle of a 30-year marriage and see how that goes over. It's like a turn in the punch bowl.
Who in the hell are you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And why didn't you tell me? So you know, sometimes you get these things where you know, you find out that you're not who exactly you thought you were, and you better be prepared for what you find out. You know, I'm not saying it's Maury Povich, but it's close. It almost turns into a DNA show, man. You better be careful what you're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, it's DNA. I'm glad you mentioned that, because now, you know, for years people would claim to be related to so-and-so, and now there's a method to prove or disprove it instantly. In fact, you know, and this is a fascinating subject already, but we were talking about examining the subject of TV shows that we like, and just last night I watched on History's Greatest Mysteries,
yes,
the whole saga of John Wilkes Booth, who, of course, assassinated Abraham Lincoln on April 14th, 1865, just 5 days after Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox. And John Wilkes Booth, a lot of people may not realize, was the most famous actor in the country at the time.
Yep.
This would be like George Clooney off in the
Everybody
president.
Everybody knew who he was.
Absolutely, and there's no question he was the assassin.
Yep.
Because he did it in the middle of a play, Our American Cousin, at Ford's Theater. He was probably most famous with his brothers of portraying one of the characters in the classic Shakespeare production of Julius Caesar. So this was his greatest performance. He decided to live it out because he hated Lincoln and hated what he stood for and was pro-South and was devastated that the South had surrendered. And in the middle of this performance, he has total familiarity at Ford's Theater. He didn't even plan it until that morning because he had gone to get his mail and somebody said the president and his wife are coming to tonight's performance, and the wheels started turning. Next thing you know, he's in the box with a derringer and shoots the president, jumps to the stage and breaks his ankle in the fall from 13 feet from the presidential box, staggers to the middle of the stage and stands with his arms raised and announces to the crowd, "Sic semper tyrannis," which is the Latin from the play Julius Caesar of, you know, to tyrants comes death, is what the English interpretation. And then he stumbled off the stage, got on a horse and rode off into the night. But the amazing thing was last night's show was kind of telling and retelling that story and of his alleged demise 11 days later and the controversy as to whether or not he was really the guy who was shot in the Garrett tobacco barn by a sergeant named Boston Corbett. The long and short of the story was there were just tons of people running around that supposedly he lived another 30 or 40 years in Texas and Oklahoma and fathered a bunch of children, and all these people were, you know, thinking they were related to John Wilkes Booth their whole life. And at the very end of the show, they did DNA testing on all of these and disproved none of them had any links to John Wilkes Booth.
Yeah, well, the fact that I guess a lot of Booths were spelled with an E.
Yes.
And they thought that was somewhat of a changing the guard a little bit. Maybe he changed that as well. What was amazing to me is when they went through that genealogy, how many people looked like him back in the day.
Exactly.
He had such, I mean, everyone had the bushy mustache, the small trimmed, you know, goatee, if you will.
Almost black eyes.
I mean, everybody looked like John Wilkes Booth. It was just absolutely amazing. But no, I saw the same show. And then, of course, I saw the new episode about the Turin, which I thought was really interesting, too.
That was fascinating, too. If your faith is wavering a little bit, the Shroud of Turin, and I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar, it is alleged to be the burial cloth of Jesus Christ after the crucifixion. And, Tony, it is amazing to me watching that show of they've tried to disprove that is real for so long, and every scientific test goes kablooey because they say, okay, now we know how this happened. There was paint, there was dye, mm-hmm. there was this and that. They test the cloth. None of that is present. Then they came up with the thing. There's this ancient form of, it wasn't photography, but it was imaging. And again, I know you watch the shows. You and I have an inclination to be fascinated by these shows. But at the very end, I found my faith was just extremely renewed. I've known about the Shroud of Turin for a long time. Every 10 years, they break it out and let the latest scientific geniuses try and disprove that it's real. But what about the revelation at the end? This one I never had heard before, that one guy was speculating, he goes, why can't we just accept this could be a supernatural thing where the very burst of energy and heat and intense light? Because one guy said, this could only be replicated by, you know, hundreds or thousands of lasers projected on this cloth at one time. You know, what about the guy who said, well, can't we just, you know, accept the possibility this was a supernatural situation and that transformation that allowed him to transition from dead to life could have been the phenomenon that caused this? And, you know, it sounds like the most plausible explanation to me, because what about the lady who also said, the fact of the matter is there is nothing else in existence that even is similar to this, where the image of a man is on a cloth like this
on any other body, on any other body,
nowhere,
anywhere. There's nothing.
It's the only one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I appreciate some people are agnostic and atheist and all that stuff. You know, knock yourself out, be who you want to be. But if you can't disprove this, Tony, it's pretty startling to me. I've never been more secure in and some people might think this is a kind of a whack position, but I am absolutely convinced the Shroud of Turin is the real deal.
I totally agree with you. And, you know, and if you watch the show, and it's a great show, despite the fact there have been thousands of shows done on the same thing, it's just amazing some of the new information they have out. You know, the Bible in itself, and that's, you know, faith is the belief in things that unseen. And it's, you know, it's funny because I've got a friend of mine who we read passages every morning, not necessarily biblical passages, but they always have some biblical scripture behind them. And we were talking about faith just the other day, and I said, you know, faith is the belief of things unseen. And it's amazing what we believe in this country. From a conspiratorial standpoint, from a political standpoint, from the crap we read on the internet, from the things that we see, we are so gullible. We are so gullible, and we are such idiots sometimes. And sometimes we just don't want to. We don't want to look at the science behind it. And I'm all about, you know, God gave us the will, and He gave us the smarts to use our science and use our smarts to try to prove things and figure things out. We did that, but there are some things out there, quite frankly, we just don't know, and they are mm-hmm. mysteries. In this particular case, I'm going to paint it up to a mystery, or much like a miracle. I'm going to say, listen, it's not for me. I also believe that I think God's got a sense of humor. And I think He knows where Noah's Ark is. I think He knew that was the only piece of evidence left inside the tomb when He was raised, when He was resurrected 3 days into Easter. That was the only, and they said that actually when they found it, it appeared that He just went through the cloth, because you could actually see the imprint of His face, that it was actually raised. When they looked at it, actually looked like He was still under the shroud, if you will, and then obviously there was nothing there. So he knows what He's doing. And I think that, you know, if we want to go on wild goose chases, it's just further proof to me that there is an existence of a God or of a higher being, and that we are just small grains of sand on the grand beach of life. I just think it's a great show, and that's what we were going to talk about today. We could certainly do that again, but. The John Wilkes Booth thing was just amazing to me, because there are so many things that can tie you to things. And again, you know, we want to believe what we want to believe. And that goes for anything. Whether you think 9/11 was a fake, whether you think the school shootings in Sandy Hook was a, you know, and we got people that could, well, you think that COVID was a made man disease and that it was just there to kill people from China, whatever you want to believe, whether you think the vaccine wasn't real, whatever you want to believe, and you want to believe those things. And when you want to believe something enough, whether you want to believe she's not cheating on you. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's be real here. I mean, I've got a friend of mine and he knows it. And I know she knows. I'm like, she's cheating on you. He will not. He's like, no, she's not. And he will not let himself go because he knows it's going to hurt so much. And so it's a fight or flight situation. It's a save my ass situation where I cannot believe that or else it's going to tear me apart. And so he keeps living this lie. But when you're talking about things that if you want to believe in them enough, there's not enough science out there that's going to prove you wrong.
Yeah. So I mean, that's a self-preservation thing, what you just described.
Yeah.
You know, it's easier to convince yourself that all is well, you know, instead of dealing with the facts. One thing I thought about when you were just talking about that, Tony, is I think one of the most unfortunate things about this multimedia, you know, completely just drown you in information at your fingertips. My son said something to me when he was a teenager, 13 or 14 years ago. We were riding in the car somewhere, and I said, I wonder so-and-so. And, you know, it was the first time that I really became cognizant of the fact, because within seconds he goes, well, you know, there's really no need to wonder about anything. And he held up his phone. He goes, because the knowledge of the entire world is right here in the palm of my hand. And whatever I was wondering about, he had the answer in 15 seconds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just the different world. We lived in a world previously, before all this technology, where you did wonder about things and you did think about things. Now everything is so accessible. And I think one of the saddest things is, I think it has taken away a lot of your thoughts and your formation of your own perceptions, because how many people, Tony, are wanting to believe something, but publicly will not acknowledge that belief because they think they're going to be criticized or ridiculed for their opinion. So just to kind of be one of the sheep in the flock and not stand out, they would rather just accept the narrative instead of thinking it for themselves. And I think that's really one of the downsides of this era of, you know, instant information and technology, that I don't think people use their own minds anymore and are afraid to reach their own conclusions because they're afraid they're going to be criticized.
Yeah. And you know, and to go just the opposite way now, because we all have opinions and all have our own platforms. Now you can believe that birds don't exist and actually get people to believe you.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean? I mean, come on. I mean, birds don't exist, and that was done as a joke, and there's actually people out there believe that birds are some type of robots that aren't real. And I'm like, are we and there's people that actually believe that. You know, you go back, we talk about UFOs. I don't know if you've ever seen a UFO. I have seen one. I saw one when I was 15 years old. I'll never forget.
Really?
I saw my backyard in Westchester, Ohio. I'll never forget it. I didn't do drugs. I was having a sleepover with a friend of mine, and I'll never forget what I saw. And, you know, so much too that if you're in the military or you're a pilot, you can't admit you've seen that stuff. People think you're crazy.
No.
And now all of a sudden there has been such a turn on UFOs and you know, unidentified flying objects that you know, if you don't believe in them, now you're probably on the outside looking in.
Yeah,
which is pretty
for
amazing.
Sure. Well, that brings up our other show, Ancient Aliens,
yeah,
which is kind of the mother of all these modern shows, The Unexplained, which I got to give a shout out real quick to my man, Bill Shatner. Mm. What a beast, Tony. 92 years old. He's the executive producer and the host of The Unexplained. And he still sounds like Captain Kirk 60 years after his gig. This guy is just an American icon.
Botox has been very good to him.
Oh, no kidding.
I mean, but he's used it right. He really has. He looks fantastic.
Yeah, you know, and it's amazing all of this controversy about our leaders being, you know, aged, and one of the presidential candidate Nikki Haley saying that anybody wanting to serve in public office after the age of 75 should be submitted to a cognitive test to track their abilities. But, you know, William Shatner is just a shining example of, it's not the age, it's your own functionality and where you are in terms of your progression? I mean, everybody's going to slow down and have some things removed from them as they age, but to put a number on it is really unfair because it varies wildly between one individual and another. William Shatner is still just a tremendous narrator and so eloquent. And I, of all the stories in the last few years, I love the one where year before last, I think it was 2021, now about 3 years removed, that William Shatner, Captain Kirk, actually went up on a SpaceX rocket, broke through the atmosphere, floated, rode around in space for a little while, and came right back to Earth. And when he got off of that, he was so overwhelmed. And, you think somebody 90 years old had seen it all, done it all. But William Shatner was so eloquent in relating that experience and what it meant to him. And I'm telling you, I'm the biggest William Shatner fan ever. I still go back and watch the original Star Trek episodes just to see William Shatner in his prime in action, because even that show from the late 60s was really ahead of its time. I mean, a lot of modern day issues, the Star Trek episodes take those on now, and it was almost like a glimpse into the future. So I had to get my plug in for Bill Shatner.
I used to love the TV show that he was on, Denny Crane. What was the show he was?
Boston Law or whatever.
Oh, I used to think that show was good.
What a great character Denny Crane was.
Denny Crane, and you know, he was so perfect for that. And it was a little presumptuous to believe that perhaps he was going to be one of these guys that kind of turned into an Alzheimer's, because he in his character in that show started getting Alzheimer's or some type of dementia. He actually started believing he was a different individual, and it was so good. But no, I totally agree with you. You know, it takes it back. You and I have had this discussion about Jackson Browne and about Mick Jagger, who's going to turn, 80 this November. Keith Richards is already 80. The Rolling Stones are playing Jazz Fest down in New Orleans here in a couple weeks, which is amazing to me. And you're thinking to yourself, and you know, AC/DC just announced their 50th anniversary, and they're all in their upper 70s. And, it may be just that, we think in the upper 70s, how in the world could I possibly run across from stage right to stage left 3 or 4 miles a night and not get tired? It may be because these people, and I mean this from William Shatner, from a thespian standpoint, it may be that these people are just so good at what they do that it just becomes so second nature that even a person like Tony Bennett can have full-blown dementia and Alzheimer's and be able to sing through an entire set list and not know the difference.
Yeah.
And because they've done it so much. They are so good at what they do. They are the best, the best, the best in their craft. And that it takes nothing for Mick Jagger to get up there and sing these songs that he's been singing for 60 years because they're his songs and he knows what he's going in. And for us, it'd be like us trying to get up there and sing a Rolling Stones. They're not our songs. We didn't create them. We didn't live them. And so maybe that's another way to acknowledge the fact that there are so many people in their 70s that are still getting up there and rocking and rolling who just look like they haven't missed a beat.
That was my favorite part of our interview with Damon Johnson last week, who's now lead guitarist for Lynyrd Skynyrd. He was on the starting lineup Saturday mornings, 10:30 on ABC 3340, by the way. Damon Johnson came on. Tony's got a great relationship with him. It was my first chance to converse. And I love the part where we talked about, because I had thrown out to him to get his reaction, that I love this era of so many rock and roll icons still out there doing their thing, just like you described. And, I said, arguably, some of them are as good or even better now at this stage than they even were in their, quote, prime, because they're so comfortable in their own skin. And like you just very eloquently laid out there, that perhaps this is such a second nature thing. This is the environment that they thrive in, that they're most comfortable in, just like us sitting down on a microphone with no preparation whatsoever. This to me is the most natural thing in the world. I don't need to prepare for these shows. I do my show on your network, Need to Know, where I just kind of wax about whatever that I want to talk about. I don't use notes. I don't feel like communicating in some kind of regimented way is the way to go. So maybe we're kind of living examples of what you're talking about.
And so much that you told Damon Johnson, what's it like to be the young pup?
Yeah,
he's in his 50s.
Because he rattled off a bunch of guys in their 70s and stuff. And he had shared with us that when Leonard Skinner's plane crash happened in 1977, he's in the eighth grade. So I did a little bit of quick computation. I said, good grief, Damon, you're just a pup.
Yeah, that's so amazing. And where are we at? Where Gary Rosington was the last remaining member of the band.
Yes.
He's now gone. Damon's taken that over. And because the pieces were so interchangeable years ago by bringing in Van Zandt, bringing in family members and everything else, the band has just kind of reformulated itself. You could change a member next week and I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know who's,
yeah,
as long as they can play the notes and sing the songs. And so it's changed so many times over the last 20 or 30 years that Leonard Skinner to me is still Leonard Skinner, despite the fact there's not one remaining member of the band. And they're on tour with ZZ Top, who of course is Dusty, Billy, and Frank, and Dusty's dead too. There's only two-thirds of the band play. So, I mean, you know, it's just, but they're still selling out. People, as long as it still sounds good, and they're playing the music to heart, and they're playing with reverence and playing with respect, it's good to go. So, hey,
who
Greg,
did they get to replace Dusty? Tony, I'm not sure.
I do not know, and I should know this, but they brought a guy in who was a studio musician that has been playing with their band for a long period of time. I was actually hoping Austin Hanks, who is a good friend of mine. He played in a band called Slick Lily.
I remember Slick Lily.
They used to play a place called Rockin' M Palace, which was right next to Sammy's across the street. I used to bring them on stage all the time.
And
Austin Hanks played with Slick Lily, and now Austin Hanks is plays in this band with Billy Gibbons called the Big Bad Blues Band, and it's him, it's Billy, and then it's Matt Sorum, who of course played drums for Guns N' Roses of all three.
Oh, how about
and
that?
And if you ever get a chance to go check out, you love just great Texas blues, man. It is fantastic. It is really, really good. All right, so coming up here on a Saturday morning, can't wait to do this show with you. You know, we had Damon Johnston on last week. We're going to have celebrities, and we're going to talk about all different kinds of things, but we're going to really get into something I think is going to be really interesting, and we've already gone way over, and there's no rhyme or reason to this. We can talk as long as we want. It's our show, the Kiefer and Curry Show. But the starting lineup, when we're talking about legalized gambling in the state, and I've heard this on numerous occasions, I want to say we're one of five states that does not have a lottery. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so I had heard that we were one of three, and now we're one of five. We're going to get into the nuts and bolts of this thing, and we got a 30-minute show. We may go the whole 30 minutes on it because I have so many questions for you. You are the executive director of the Birmingham Racecourse Casino. You know everything about Parimutuel, about gambling, about where these bills have been, why they haven't passed back in the 90s, where they're headed, will they pass again, why we have bingo halls, why we don't have bingo halls, why they're pulling plugs, why they're sticking the plugs back in, you know, why the Birmingham Racecourse has casino machines. I don't understand it. I thought that was not legal. We're going to get into all that stuff coming up on Saturday, so it's going to be amazing stuff, and it looks like they're pushing this through pretty quickly. But the one thing, and just to kind of give you something to smoke in your pipe before we do the show on Saturday, it seems like they can't find a happy middle ground. It's either we're going to allow everything, and just as a gambler, I would love it if we had a casino or two. Do I want 10 casinos? I don't think I want 10 casinos. I don't want the 10 top cities in Alabama to all have casinos because I know how corrupt this state is.
Yeah.
Do I want a lottery? Yeah, I want a lottery. I think that's good. So is there some way where we can kind of, because it seems like if we're going to do it, we're going all the way with it. And I don't think the people are ready for it in the state.
It's sports betting also is part of this. So you would be able to drive to the Birmingham Racecourse Casino and get down on all that day's games, right? Just like Las Vegas. And I think that's a viable question. Is Alabama ready to be Las Vegas? Do you think
we're ready?
I think that the time and place to make this move is probably here because, you know, you're hearing the same testimony from people that are against it, that this is going to cause the dissolution of families and bankruptcies and crime. And all of that was a great argument in 1970. But just like we talked about this information era, Tony, all of this is at your fingertips right now. Yeah. You don't even have to leave your house, and you can sign up for any number of offshore casinos and betting sites and be in action on your iPad or your laptop, your phone.
For years, by the way, for the last 10 years.
This is the reality now. Not to mention the fact that if you're really inclined to exercise compulsive behavior, a couple hour drive over to Philadelphia, Mississippi is not a big barrier.
No.
When the lottery is at $1 billion, driving to Carrollton, Georgia, or Flora, Alabama, to Mariana, Florida, or over to the border to Mississippi is not a giant pilgrimage. So all of these fears that Alabama is going to collapse under its own weight if this is available is really unrealistic now, because it's here to stay, and you may as well have your state benefit. Conservative estimates are this can create $1 billion a year in revenue for the state of Alabama, just the limited form of gaming that we're able to offer right now at the Birmingham Racecourse Casino. We just distributed $7.5 million to a bunch of recipients, and we're going to start having some videos on those. Things like Children's Hospital, the City of Birmingham, Miles College, the Alabama Animal Welfare Association, all these very worthwhile entities are directly benefiting from people's entertainment choices. And it's kind of ridiculous to let that revenue go to Georgia and go to Mississippi and go to Florida.
I just hope. I'm okay with it. I just hope it's done right. I hope the right people have legal jurisdiction to the money, and I hope that it's well regulated. I've seen my city council. I don't know how many mayors ever went from Siegelman to Mayor Langford. I've seen so many of my corrupt legal servants just left me high and dry with closet fulls of fresh new linen shirts that no one knows where they came from. Yeah. I'm just kind of like, if the money goes in the right place, and I'll say this, my brother lives up in Lawrenceburg, up in Indiana, and they're roughly making $1 million a day.
Mm-hmm.
They're making so much money. I mean, if you're a B student, you go to state college, you're not paying for anything, which I think would be fantastic here. They're making so much money that they're repaving streets that don't need to be repaved.
Yeah.
They don't know what to do with the money up there. And then you go to Mississippi and Philadelphia, and that was really raised to a heck of a hullabaloo. It was just unbelievable how exciting it was. And now all of a sudden the casinos are only open Friday and Saturday nights, and it looks like, it's desolate. I mean, it's sad. I mean, it's just because the wrong people got a hold of it. If the money's being regulated, it's going to where it should go. I think it could be a really wonderful thing. All right, we'll talk about it Saturday morning right here. The starting lineup on ABC 3340, info@TonyCurryRadio.net, info@TonyCurryRadio.net. If you've got anything you want to talk about, we'll get into it right here on the Kiefer and Curry Show.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.